I'm here on the Dublin Mountains in the parish of Killickee, and I'm with historian Frank Tracy. Frank, a lovely morning to start a tour of this area.
Yes, Morris, it's lovely. Just to talk, we're on the Massey Estate, or what was the Massey Estate. Just very quickly, what happened to Masseys? They originated in France and Avranches back before the Battle of Hastings, and came in with William the Conqueror into Hastings. They got quite a lot of land, mainly in Cheshire, around Chester, and there'd still be a lot of Masseys there, and most of the Masseys in Ireland would originate from the Cheshire Masseys. And then one of them, Hugh Massey, came over with Cromwell, and for his efforts on behalf of Cromwell, got quite a lot of land in the Limerick area. But then, much later, the fourth Baron married the daughter of Luke White, who was a billionaire at the time. And through that family, the Masseys got a second huge tranche of land here at Killickee, where they got about 3,000 acres, and another 20,000 acres up in Leitrim around the Kinloch area. The sixth Baron Massey, he is a man who sold off all the tenanted land under the Land Act and got quite a lot of money for it. And this would have been in the 1880s. And the problem that then arose was that he retained the four mansions that they then had, and lived as a lord and like a lord, and unfortunately for the rest of his family, lived another 38 years. And he used to move from one mansion to the other, like Fawcett Circus, and he had a fabulous life from his point of view. But when he died in 1915, it was found that not only was the land money gone, but he had mortgaged the houses to keep up his lifestyle.
He lost a fortune.
He lost a fortune. And the one, I suppose, who ultimately suffered was his grandson, the man who died here at Killickee, because by 1924 they were down to one mansion, which was Killickee. They owed a lot of money to the bank, and the bank foreclosed. And the eighth Baron Hammond famously said to the bailiffs when they came that he wouldn't be leaving this house till he was carried out of it, meaning when he died. But they said, "Right, my lord," and lifted him up on the mattress, carried him down the driveway, and dumped him out in the road just above where we are here now. And after negotiations, he and his wife and son were given this little three-roomed, no, not three-bedroom, three-roomed gate lodge where we're standing now, well, called Beehive Cottage.
Let's walk down and have a close look at this place. How did it get its name, Beehive?
Well, it's designed to look a little bit like a beehive, and on the gates you can see wrought iron beehives on either side of the gate. They used to call the lodges all these little quaint names, you know, that was kind of typical of the Anglo-Irish. But this particular lodge is situated in a magnificent location, because when you walk around the back of it, you can see the entire city of Dublin underneath you. But Hammond Massey, the eighth Baron, and his wife Mrs. Massey, spent 34 years living here. He had a drink problem, so he never really worked. She got a job in the Irish Sweepstakes and worked there for the next 38 years. And she used to go in from here every day into Ball's Bridge, get the bus in Rockbrook, walk down to Rockbrook, get the bus in, and work in the Irish Sweepstakes. And at weekends, out there on the little space in front there at the gateway, she'd put out tables and chairs and sell teas and coffees to hikers. And he lived out the rest of his life here, a beaten man, a very sad man. I suppose, looking at it now, he was probably clinically depressed. But there was no treatment, there was no sympathy for them in those days. And he died in 1958, aged 64. She stayed another 2 years. Her son, Hughie, had gone to England during the war and had signed up and served in North Africa and the Middle East, and settled down in England, married an Irish girl, Margaret Flower. So 2 years after the eighth Baron died, Margaret Massey left Ireland, went over and spent the rest of her days with Hughie and the grandchildren over there in England.
But the Massey line continues.
The Massey line is still there. The title is still there. David, interestingly, all the Lord Masseys, the elder sons, right from the first Hugh Massey who came in with Cromwell, were all called Hugh, all the elder sons. But Hughie, who was the eighth Baron's son who went to England, fought in the war and married Margaret Flower, he broke with the tradition. His eldest son is David, and David holds the title. But of course, it's almost meaningless at this stage. He's just an ordinary chap like us, working away in England, and it's all history to them too. It's now history.
Now, we're going to go on a tour of the area here. Yes. So where are you
we'll pass,
going to take me to next?
We'll go from Beehive Cottage up, and I'll show you on the way up the spot where Hammond Massey was dumped under a hood, and as we just passed in the car. Then we're going up the Luke White, who bought the estate, and you remember it passed through his daughter into the Masseys. When he came here, this was a shooting estate of the Connolly family from Castletown, Speaker Connolly. And the only house that was on the estate at that time was what's now called Killiquay House, but that's a misnomer. It was the shooting lodge, and it later became the Stewart's Lodge under Lord Massey's time, the stables and so on. And it's rather ironic that the oldest building that was here is almost the only one left at the end of the day, because the mansion is gone. We'll be going down to look at where the mansion was. I'll show you the front lawns and pictures of the mansion, and then we go down and look at the gardens.
Okay. Now we made our way up to the place where he was literally carted out of his bed, lying on a mattress, and thrown on the road here.
Yes. Now you can see here, Morris, just the last remnant. See the old iron gate post there and the pillar, and there was a little lodge there. And this was the nearest gate lodge to the actual house. And that's the old avenue running down there. That's all new. O'Kelly's, timber yard is all new. But this here was the original gateway. So when the bailiffs arrived, and he tried to tell them that he was sick and that he wouldn't be moved and all the rest of it, but they weren't having any of that. So they lifted him up on the mattress, carried him down the drive. And you can imagine, this is 1924. The Masseys had been millionaires, and all the locals worked for them and so on in their day. And to see Lord Massey being carried down on a mattress with his wife and child behind him, and he was dumped literally on the road there. Now, Mrs. Reed, who was a widow at that time, she lived in that cottage there, and she took him in out of sympathy. The wife and children were taken in by the foxes up there where the old Connolly shooting lodge is. And then negotiations started, and eventually the bank agreed to give them the little three-roomed gate lodge that we saw. Beehive Cottage. Mm-hmm. And that's where they lived out.
Did this cottage have a name?
No, just Reed. So I don't think it had a name. If it did, I never traced what the name was. Yeah. No, Beehive Cottage was particularly beautiful. And said, now, it was a three-roomed cottage. No facilities, toilets or water or anything. But there, so this is the spot where he was dumped on the road. So we'll move on up now, and I'll show you where the big house itself was. Well, we're here now, Morris, at the entrance to Massey Woods. And I suppose, strictly speaking, if we're to be historically correct, it should be called White's Wood, because it was the Whites who bought the estate, Luke White. It was the Whites who built the house, the Whites who did the gardens. Lord Massey just fell into it by virtue of the fact that Matilda White married the fourth Baron Massey. An important thing about these Masseys is to remember that the name is spelled M-A-S-S-Y, whereas the more common Massey is M-A-S-S-E-Y. Now, the reason for that is that the Cheshire Masseys were M-A-S-S-E-Y, but the chap who came over with Cromwell, Hugh Massey, for some reason, and historically it was fortuitous, makes it easier to trace his family, but for some reason he dropped the E And right from the beginning, when he came at Cromwell, he spelled it M-A-S-S-Y. So all his descendants are M-A-S-S-Y. So if you see a Massey M-A-S-S-Y, that person is a descendant of the Hugh Massey that came here with Cromwell. Unfortunately, as time goes on, other people, the minute they see the name, they insist on putting an E in it. And in the case of this family, it's not correct. Now, we're walking down towards the only building that was here at the time that Luke Wright bought the estate, and that was the Connolly Shooting Lodge. In time, it became the steward's house for Lord Massey, and Lord Massey extended the stables and so on. They became the stable yards for the big house. In more recent times, it became a restaurant and took the name Killickey House, although strictly speaking, Killickey House was the big mansion. That restaurant closed about 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't think that the building has been put to any particular use since then. Now we're just going to turn into Massey Woods.
Now looking into those woods, there are some very fine trees. Many of those trees would have been put down here by the Masseys many, many years ago.
Strictly speaking, by the Whites. Lord Massey just enjoyed the place insofar as he fell in. It was the Whites who did all the gardens, the trees, the house, and so on. There are magnificent trees here, and as we pass some of them later on, some of the more spectacular ones, I'll show you them. And you can pass. Now, this road we're standing on now is a modern forestry road. The actual driveway is just below us there. So the horse and carriages used to come into the big house down there, swing around here, and if you lean over here, you'll see another little gate lodge here. And they went straight across there and into the stable yards.
So, but you see the lovely sweep and the road.
Oh yes,
up
absolutely
along.
Yes.
And you know, you can imagine the
carriages.
And just going into these magnificent buildings across the way.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the man who blew all the money, the extraordinary thing, he right up to the day he died, he was 80 when he died. In his early 70s, he discovered cars. And he bought a whole fleet of cars and then had something that was almost unique in the ascendancy. And I'll show you a photograph later. He bought a charabanc, one of these big early buses. And he used to bring his friends up shooting up the mountains and all that. So, I mean, he lived a fabulous life.
Was he eccentric?
Well, even, yes, he probably was a bit, but he loved the idea of being Lord Massey, and he was noted as a great host. He had great parties. I have had access to family photographs. He was holding parties, and Lord Massey's was the place to be, shooting parties. Then down in Castle Connell, where they had 8,500 acres on the Shannon, they'd go fishing. And his estate up in Kinloch, the Drowse River, is still regarded as probably the finest salmon fishing river in Ireland today, and so he owned all that.
Really lived up to his name.
Oh, absolutely, till the day he died. Now he I suppose I wouldn't say good fortune, it helped a bit that he fell out with his only son.
How did that come about?
I never got to the basis of it. I know that he never got on with the son's wife's family. Might have felt the son married a bit below himself, because he, the sixth Baron, had married a daughter of the Earl of Carrick, which is the Butler family, and they were, with the Fitzgeralds, were the premier people. And he may have felt the son married below himself or whatever, but they fell out. And that may have eased his conscience in terms of letting the family fortunes wind down. Unfortunately, if our father blew a load of money, it wouldn't matter to us. But these families set up family trusts to protect the money. But it also had a downside, that the liabilities passed from one generation to the other. So the son, who had fallen out of the father and who enjoyed none of all this, inherited all the debts when the father died in 1915. And the father had the good fortune to be born at the start of the Victorian era, and to die 5 months before the 1916 rising. So he saw the whole thing through.
and left his poor son with
and
all
the
debts.
Son with it.
And
now the son...
With such bad times too, with you know, falling into the troubles, 1916.
All that,
23.
And the son died also a relatively young man in his 60s, at having stumbled along in 1926. So it was the grandson who got the full whack and got thrown out on the road up here. As you go up the road towards the feather beds, beyond Killikey, just above here, a few hundred yards, there's an extremely tight bend in the road to the left. And if you look into the right, you see the remains of an old reservoir in the Piperstown Gorge. And that was the reservoir for the Massey estate. And pipes ran out of that reservoir down to the stables, down to the house, down to the gardens and so on. And this structure we're looking at here, this was the water tank for the house.
Okay, to just describe this now.
Well, it's a stone structure built out of rough stone and plastered on the inside. It would be about 30 feet long by about 4 or 5 feet wide, and raised up out of the ground. I suppose in its day it's full of muck and so on, but it probably would have been about 12 feet deep. And the water flowed into that from the reservoir above, and that in turn fed the house here and the fountains and so on and the lawns. And there's another one of these back up at the old Connolly shooting lodge, and that supplied the stables.
Have you any idea who was the engineer?
Well, I don't know the engineer for the house or building house, but the man who did the gardens was a very famous gardener called Ninian Niven, and he did a lot of the Ascendancy gardens in Ireland. We're just passing now an Irish oak tree here. See it here?
Magnificent, isn't it?
But yeah. You're saying now that's magnificent, but later on the walk, I'm going to show you what I consider to be the finest oak tree in Ireland.
My goodness,
down
yes.
Below. Now, we're heading down to have a look at where the house was and what's left. That's another oak tree there in front of us.
They're towering over us, about 40, 50
Irish
feet
oaks,
tall.
Yeah. Yeah. Irish oaks.
Well, what's extraordinary about this place is the... We're so high up in the mountains.
Yes.
You know, and this would have had a commanding view of Dublin itself and the bay.
Yeah.
And
Killikey House... A lot of these Ascendancy houses, well, most of them are very imposing. Killikey House, and I'll be showing you a photograph in a minute, was absolutely beautiful. And given its location, if it had somehow survived another 30 years, it would be now a hotel or a golf place or whatever. But at the time, 1924, the bank, in fairness, put a caretaker into it and kept the caretaker there because they realized it was a beautiful house until 1941, but never found a buyer. And in 1941, it was sold to a salvage merchant. And that person dismantled it bit by bit and sold off fireplaces and sold off staircases and so on, but dismantled the whole thing bit by bit.
And there was an auction?
Well, people came up and, well, he bought it and he demolished it and he sold off all the bits and pieces that were bought at that time.
And that happened in 1944?
1941. Here's an American redwood, a sequoia tree. See it there?
I do.
And they don't grow to the full height in Ireland, but they're still...
very impressive.
Very impressive, yeah. Now, we're going into where the house was. Here, now, there's someone burning a load of stuff here, but... So I'll just show you the picture. And
of course, the reason for the picture is that there isn't a trace upon
you don't
upon a trace.
Well, there is a trace. Wait till you see this. Now watch this. You're standing exactly where this photograph was taken. Do you see that plinth?
I do. The plinth is right there in
there,
front of us.
There. And you see the boundary of a little flower arrangement there. And see the bank with the steps over there. The house sat on the top of that bank, just to the right
of
that house.
But there isn't a trace upon a trace
of nothing of the
house.
No, nothing of the house. And in fact, I have appealed to the chap who owns this site here. Please don't remove that plinth, because you can see how important
I know
it is to. Now let's move along another bit. Do you see that other rectangular plinth over there?
Yes.
Well, that's this one, and we're standing there.
Yeah.
So you're looking at the front lawn.
But it shows
here.
You the magnificence now, of the garden and how well it was laid out.
This is the early 1900s, and there was a balustrade running along. Do you see that granite?
Mm-hmm.
Plinth there. See the balustrade running along it there? And you see those two monkey puzzle trees? Now, this was taken around the late 1800s, around 1900. Do you see that monkey puzzle tree there?
Yeah.
It fell down.
Oh,
just
yes.
Just during
still
last
there.
Winter. Okay?
It only fell down last winter.
Last winter. And do you see that fountain there?
Yeah.
Look over the monkey puzzle tree in the middle of it. And do you see the remains of the fountain?
Yeah. So you still have bits and pieces of the garden.
There's the fountain there, and there it is as it is today.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was Neptune, and you can see the stonework of the fountain, and the circle is still there. So that's the front lawn, and there it is in its heyday. Now, without those photographs, it would be almost impossible to describe what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Now, that monkey puzzle tree fell down and was all chopped up, and that chap is now burning branches of it, and so on. And the second monkey puzzle tree is still there. Do you see it sticking up?
Yes, up I there? Do, yeah.
And that's
that's the second
this one
there, yeah.
The second monkey puzzle tree.
Yeah.
So there you are. Wasn't it a beautiful house? Look.
It was.
Absolutely
it was,
beautiful.
Again, the architect, you're not...
No, I don't know the architect. Now, none of these later growths would have been here. So you can imagine, this house looks straight out over the city of Dublin. Absolutely magnificent view. And you can imagine that when Ireland began to improve a bit financially, that house would have been snapped up. Yeah. It was so it's just unfortunate.
Couple of years too soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we'll continue now with our journey and walk
yes.
back up again.
We're going down a track here now towards the gardens. But on the way, I'm going to show you a very unusual feature. The original driveway came through here. And the avenue was renowned for the fact that it was lined on both sides by monkey puzzle trees.
Which
there's
are,
very few
can,
of them left.
Yes,
there's
you can still
there's
see
two
a few.
Or three of them left, and you can see where the avenue went through. And the avenue swung off the military road, and what we're going down to now is the last remnant of the military road in its original state. That's the road that the military built after the 1798 rebellion to get at the rebels who had retreated into the Wicklow Hills, and they built a number of barracks at Glen Creed, a famous reconciliation centre, another one at Lara, another one at Glenmalure, Drumgoff, and one at Ochavanna, which became a youth hostel. Now all that road is now tarred, you know, it's modernised and tarred, with the exception of this bit, which is the original military road as it was, and the only bit that you can see in its original state. And that's where we're going now.
Was all the land around here Massey land?
About 3,000 acres. Luke White bought two estates up here. He bought Killikey estate from the Connollys, and he also bought Woodtown Manor further down the road towards Rathfarnham. And it was his son Luke Jr. set up in Woodtown, and Luke White himself built the house here around 1800. When he died, he left it to the son with about 3,000 acres. And the son, Luke Jr., was married but never had any children. And Luke's sister, Matilda White, married the fourth Baron Massey, who died very young. And when Luke died, he left the estate to his wife for her lifetime, and thereafter to pass on to John Thomas Massey, Matilda's son. And John Thomas, in time, became the sixth Baron Massey. Now, if we stand here, Morris, this is the military road.
Dead straight, as you would expect a military road to be.
Now, The avenue into Lord Massey's, you can see, just swung right there. See it?
Yeah.
Going up there. Now, in time, the route of the military road was changed. It originally came through Rockbrook, but later on it came up through Stocking Lane.
Why?
I'm not quite sure. It's probably a straighter run. This had become a private domain and so on. Now, you know, of course, the origin of Stocking Lane.
No, you tell me.
When the British troops would go in convoy across the mountains, it was quite dangerous to Glencree and onwards and so on. They would come from different barracks in Dublin City to gather together to stock up.
Oh, is that right?
That's Stocking Lane was the gathering place of the convoys, because they all wouldn't come from one barracks. Yeah. You know, some materials would come from one area, probably infantry from another area, and they would stock up in what became known as Stocking Lane. And that's where the name...
Aren't place names so important?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and you get a picture of what happened.
Most people think it's something to do with socks, but it's the stocking up, where they stocked up before heading off.
What about the place names around here?
Well, Killochee is the blind man's wood. Killochee, the wood of the blind man. I mean, these things go way back into ancient history.
Always forestry, woodland here.
Yeah, woodland here. And there would have been natural woodland here. Now, in more recent years, Kielce have taken it over. Originally Land Commission, and then Kielce. But they're using it now as a kind of a wildlife type of... woods, you know, they're not manicuring it or whatever. You can see here on your left now where there's an oak tree plantation, and that was done by Ballyroan Boys National School during Tree Week. And these are all young oak trees which will be replanted out. We're going down now to see this oak tree I told you about that I consider to be the finest one in Ireland.
Well, I cannot leave this place without seeing that.
Yeah, okay. And then we'll swing around to the garden.
I was just asking you about some of the place names, and as we're walking down towards the gardens here,
yes.
What, I mean, is there any indication at all as to what, you know, the different areas around here were called and what their meaning might be?
Well, I'm sure there is, and I have some books at home which explain the different place names around here, but it's not an area that I paid particular attention to in my research. But it's all there to be researched, and all the place names, the derivations of them can be found reasonably easy, you know. So it could be done as a distinct exercise fairly quickly. Just ahead of you there on the left, ahead and slightly left, is this oak tree. And that's as fine an Irish oak tree as you will ever see. It's Irish oak, sizal oak.
Yeah, well, even from this distance, it looks magnificent. It's, what is it, about 60 feet high? And
it would be,
spreading up into the air.
Yes, and it's almost as broad as it is high. And it has the space to do that. And if you were a child and asked to draw a tree, that's what you'd draw, you know what I mean? And look at the number
branches
of branches
everywhere.
I mean, absolutely. That tree now would be in its prime now. And you won't see a finer Irish oak tree than that. Isn't it absolutely magnificent? Is the military road going down there, and that goes down to what would have been the main entrance to the estate. The main entrance to the estate was from the Rockbrook end. And older people around here have told me that their parents told them that there were times when there was a continuous flow of carriages coming up this avenue here to Lord Massey's for parties and evenings and dances and so on. So Lord Massey's was the place to be. And you can imagine, even in those days, the view out over Dublin City, which wouldn't have been as big as it is now, but it was absolutely stupendous, the view. And I'll show you later, Morris, photographs of these house parties and so on. Because in my research, I have met many members of the Massey family, Each of them would have some photographs, but not many, because the way the collapse came about, there was nothing really left. But I've been able to put together, through the kindness of these people, a collection of about 150 photographs of the Massey family in its heyday.
Yeah. Oh, indeed, it has been a great piece of work.
Yeah.
How many years have you been working on this?
Well, before I wrote the book, it was 3 years research. And since the book was published, it has gone through two further printings. And now I've got more information. And it's now about to be reprinted, but as a second edition with the additional information.
Yes.
In it. And in fact, I'm going tomorrow to look at the proofs.
Yes.
And it should be printed within next month or two. Now, there were curvilinear conservatories in here, a la the botanic gardens. All gone. All gone. And they were demolished and taken away by the citizenry of Dublin because the Land Commission just wasn't interested in them at the time. And people come up here and took whatever they felt like taking over many years, and it's all gone. And imagine, this wasn't their main estate. They fell into this through marriage. Hermitage in Castle Connell, which stood on 6,500 acres.
Down in County Limerick.
County Limerick, yeah, and on the Shannon. That was their seat. The original place they came into was a place called Duntreleague. That's the land they got off Cromwell.
Where was that?
And that is near the village of Galbally in County Limerick. And there's an old church now, which only the tower remains, but beside it, there is a charnel house, or mausoleum, that has 27 Massey coffins in it. And I managed to trace all 27 people, and they're listed in the back of the book. Looking up above Morris here, you can see the walls of the gardens now.
And what's dividing us is this lovely stream here.
This is the Owen Dower River, the Dark River, Owen Dower, Dark River. And
do we cross over?
No, we will, a little bridge further up. But at the back here, see that wall there? That's the main garden. But see the little building here in the shade?
Yeah, this is a very big high stone wall.
It is, oh yes, it'll be 20 feet high. But this little remains of a building here, this was a fernery. Because fernery in each shade and so on. So this was a fernery here. And in fact, I have an article from a gardening gazette of around 1860. Which describes a day in Killiquay at its heyday. And with that article, you can walk around this estate and identify where everything was.
The fernery, which yes. We're looking at there, what exactly went on there?
Well, I'm not a gardener, but there are many, many different breeds of ferns. And the ascendancy families liked these ferns, planted around the house and so on. And this was a nursery for ferns. Now, for ferns, you need a particular type of environment. You need shade and damp and so on. And this was a fernery built onto the wall of the garden where they would propagate ferns. And they would then be planted out around the estate. So that's the remains of the fernery there. Now, this gardening article I've told you about from the 1860s from a gardening magazine, on the day that the person went around who wrote the article, he described the fernery being built at the time that he visited the estate.
What year?
It was in the 1860s. They were building the fernery.
Oh my goodness, well over 160,
70
years ago.
These trees with the funny kind of growth on the bottom, they're lime trees. And there's another redwood down there. You see it down there?
I do. And you see the way they all form a line?
Yeah, well, this was known as the lime walk. And when you read that gardening article, he describes the lime walk. And there were actually both sides. You see, trees would have disappeared over the years. But this was a lime walk.
Can you imagine how brilliant this place must have been?
Yeah. On the other hand, you can see where the money went. It all cost money. Oh, it was absolutely spectacular.
How many gardeners? Have you any idea the number of people that were employed here?
I don't know, but a lot. And of course, he was the big employer for the whole area. And people thought very highly of him because between the coachman and the stables and the farms and the gardens, sure, he was the employer around here. And I'll show you photographs of the sixth baron later, and in every photograph he's wearing a different set of clothes, and he was a very dapper man, always well dressed, but you never see him in the same set of clothes twice. But he was a millionaire, you know. He made the mistake when the tenant of the estates were sold off. The tenant of the estates are outlying farms that he owned where the people were paying him rent. And that's quite distinct from the domain, which was his area, you know what I mean, the walled area. So all the tenanted land was sold off. He sold it off very early. In fact, he didn't do as well as others, because if he'd held on later to the later land acts, he'd have done a lot better. But he got about 9 million for the tenanted estates. But he kept four big domains.
Well, he was a man of means, but he also married into money.
Oh, he did, yeah. But he would have got a big dowry in that for it. But he kept not only the four big mansions, but the domains that went with them, and he maintained them. And all this cost horrendous amounts of money.
And he lived in another.
Well, you see,
the tenants mostly, was it?
Up to then, the rent was his income. You know what I mean? And he had a regular income. He might have had an income, maybe about 10,000-15,000 a year, which was a lot of money then. Like, you know, I talk of mega money back then. Now all that was gone, so there's no income left. But he's got this capital. Now, what he needed to do was retrench. Certainly cut down to one mansion. If he was really a business person, give up the mansions, because that day was over, and buy a street in Dublin and Balls Ridge or somewhere, you know. But they didn't think that way. His whole interest was shooting and fishing and society.
But if that was your way of life, not only in your life, but also in his father's life.
Absolutely.
And his grandfather, he was going to continue with that
tradition.
And
he sat in the House of Lords up to the day he died, you know. Did yes, he was a representative here in the House of Lords. And he was now living off the capital, and lived for another 38 years. The only investment I could find is that he put 10,000, which would be about a million in present time, about a million, he put into the Sligo Leitrim Railway. Now, railways didn't turn out to be a good bet, but the Sligo Leitrim Railway, and by the time he died, that was worth £3.17 and 6p, the 10,000.
My goodness, so
that was that 10,000 down was a million. Now that was a million gone down the tubes.
So a man that made great money to run his estates, but a man that lost money heavily.
He had no business acumen at all. No. And the only way of life he knew was the life of a peer. Back and forward to London, house parties. This is another Redwood.
What a magnificent,
indeed. Sequoia, Redwood.
Yeah. It's Sequoia, quite like a yew tree, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but it's much bigger, of course. You know, look at the height of it. And like in California, where they come from, they grow to a ginormous height. And there are...
That's as high as 4, 5, 6-story building, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, there are Sequoias in California, which I believe are 4,000 years old. And that, I'm told, makes them the oldest living thing on Earth. You know, still living.
Put a date on that tree.
Well, that would have been planted in the early 1800s.
So it's a young tree, really, isn't it?
Well, yeah, for a sequoia it is. Now, it's out of its environment, of course.
Yes.
Its natural environment is California. Now, we're walking around now, Morris Cross, nice quaint little bridge here, and over and into the gardens.
and it's important.
It's important to remember that it's the whites who developed all this. Lord Massey just enjoyed the fruits of it. You know, he wasn't into gardening or anything else. Now,
well, just before we go any further, talk about the whites. Where did they originally come
from? Well, Luke White, it's believed that they were a Huguenot family and that the original name was LeBlanc. So that's where you get the white from. And that they're of Huguenot origin, that the family lived in Cork. And he had business acumen. It was said of him, he was one of these people, no matter what he touched, it turned into money. And he made millions. And around 1800, he loaned the then government £500,000. Now, £500,000 in 1800, you'd need a very big page for the number of knots that would have to go on. His son eventually became Lord Annerley. And that title still exists. He owned Luttrellstown Castle. He owned Gowran, where the racing takes place now, Gowran Castle. And he owned thousands and thousands of acres of land all over the country. He was a businessman. He was in the book business and he was in the lottery business, interestingly enough. He had a very interesting... There was a lottery then where there was a draw, say, every week kind of thing, like the prize bonds. But ordinary people couldn't afford to buy a ticket. So what Luke White would do is that he would get a ticket and you would buy it for a week and I'd buy it next week and someone else would buy it the following week, so that the accumulated income from the ticket was way beyond what the ticket cost, but none of us could afford to buy the full ticket. And if it won on your week, well, good luck to you.
My goodness, and that's the way he operated.
But he had this, you know, even today, there are people who have this state of mind that no matter what they touch, turns into money. Unfortunately, he didn't pass it on to the Masseys, but he did pass on Killikee through his daughter to the Masseys.
And that's how the Masseys came in here, was through marriage.
His daughter, Matilda, married the fourth Baron Massey. And
we'll walk through the
his son here. Luke, who owned Killikee, died without issue.
His fourth son.
No, his son.
Yes.
Luke White's son.
It was his son then, was it?
Three of his sons. One of them was Lord Annerley, and he kept his own land. But three of the sons, one married and died without issue, and two didn't marry. And Samuel White, who was here in Killikee, he had no children, so Killikee passed to his sister Matilda, and from her to the sixth Baron. The other two brothers, who had 20,000 acres up in Leitrim in Kinloch, they passed that also on to the sixth Baron Massey. So by the time they all died, if you take the original Massey land down in Castleconnell and what they got through the whites, the sixth Baron had 34,000 acres of land and four mansions. And on the day he died, it emerged that it was all gone.
And how could anybody lose so much wealth over a lifetime?
Well, he sold off all the tenanted land, where there were tenant farmers, which would have been 90% of the land. Now, he got well paid for that, but the minus now is he has no income. And he was living the life of a billionaire. You know, he had four mansions, all these carriages, all these staff. He was a representative peer and so on. And he kept the four mansions.
Yeah. So loads of assets, but no money to back it.
Yeah, he was capital rich, but, yeah, you know.
What about the Hellfire Club that's quite near us here? Well, would he have gambled, do you think?
No, that was all... By the time Luke White bought this land, 1800, that era was gone. The era of the Hellfire Club was the 1700s. And the ascendancy then, the women didn't like them gambling around the place and so on. So they set up these Hellfire Clubs, which they called them. It became a fad. And there were a number of them around the country. And this one was built by the Connollys as a gambling house for men. And they used to go up there on the horses, and they would gamble and drink and all the rest, and the lovely view over Dublin. But it was a phase. You know, you have phases today of different. It was a phase. It was a phase related to the 18th century, the 1700s.
Right. So,
but
so
by the early 1800s, it was gone.
Was it a membership club?
Yeah, a membership thing. Yeah.
And you had to be a member of the. Of the landed gentry.
Oh, the landed gentry, yeah. Oh, yeah, there was no plebs in there. No. Now, do you see this structure behind us? Do you see this round foundation here?
Oh, barely. Yes. It's hidden in the ground and with grass growing over
even
it.
Although it's there. Look how well it's made. See the lead poured into the joints there.
Yes. If you clear the grass away.
Oh, yeah. And the circle there. And you can just make out a long rectangular structure there. See behind you there. See running along there. A kind of just barely discernible there.
What went on here?
Well, you walk up here now and I'll show you. Hey, that ground is going up in waves.
Yes.
See it right there. Now, I'm going to knock the eyes out of your head now. In a
Was this a step garden up along?
Oh, right now. I'm going to show you now. And without this photograph, you couldn't conceive of what was here.
Just stand there now. Yeah, but just to describe the way it looks now. First, it's covered in forestry. You've got a little pathway, rough pathway.
Yeah, and it's tiered. It's tiered into
little bumps up along.
Rises up and then it's flat, and then it rises up again, and then it's flat, and then it rises up again.
Okay, now I'm going to turn around. Okay, and I'm looking at a photograph that you have here.
There's where we come in.
Okay, we came in through the arch.
We come into this arch on the left.
Yeah.
There's the circular.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that was a big. That was a big glass house.
They're Turner Conservatories, curvilinear conservatories. The round one and two long ones.
Yeah.
At the back, and the fernery was the other side of the wall.
My goodness.
There.
And
there were pears and peaches and all kinds of exotic fruit in those.
And a terrace garden.
Terrace garden with fountains.
Yeah.
Lily ponds.
Flanked by fountains on both sides.
And lily ponds.
My goodness, yeah.
I mean, now can you imagine the maintenance of that now?
Yeah.
And when the estate was taken over in 1924, the house went to the bank. The land went to the land commission because there was money due and so on. It eventually passed on to the forestry division, who showed no interest in it for years and years and years and years and years. And those beautiful Turner curvilinear conservatories were demolished bit by bit over many years by the citizenry of Dublin.
And they disappeared
slowly. Well, that's what's left there now.
But what is still here is that magnificent high stone wall.
Oh yeah, the surrounding wall.
And you can see it here in the photograph.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And so what is about 15 feet high?
It would be, yeah. And it's rough stone. It's not cut stone, it's rough and very well built. I mean, all this would have cost a fortune in its day. What is evident here is the importance of even a single photograph, because without that photograph, you could not conceive of what was in this place here.
There's more to be seen, Frank, continue up along here.
It's a real indication of dereliction, isn't it, look?
Neglect over the years.
More than neglect, it's gone. Gone.
And there's traces of the steps just here.
Yeah. Now, we're leaving the formal gardens and we're going into two gardens which were divided into orchards and vegetable gardens. Now, this first one here was an orchard, but there's none of those trees left, all gone. Again, walled, and there would have been people working here all the time. And the next one we're going into then is the vegetable gardens.
Would the local people around here, they surely they would have worked for the Massies, would they?
Well, he was the employer around here. And almost every family that lived here at that time would have worked for Lord Massey. And they worked as gardeners, they worked as foresters, there was the game, he was big into the shooting, he had the whole shooting rights, all Crua Mountain, which is up there in the feather beds, and I'll show you photographs later of the shooting parties. And they would have worked in the stables, they would have worked with the carriages, he had a whole fleet of carriages, and they would have worked in the house. Mind you, in the house, like many ascendancy families, there were no Catholic staff in the house. They would have all been either Presbyterian or Church of Ireland, and some of them would have come in from Northern Ireland and England. The Massies were very Puritan, and all the outworkers would have been mainly Catholic, all right, out in the gardens and so on. And ironically, the present family is Catholic after all that, because Hammond Massey, the man who lived in the little cottage, he married a Catholic, Margaret Morden, and his parents never spoke to him again. And his son, Hughie, was reared a Catholic, went to Clongowes Wood College, and the present family are Catholic. Isn't it amazing how the whole thing turns around? Yes. Yeah.
What about the Caseys that live next door?
Well, I mean, they've been around here for generations, so the probability is that they definitely worked for Lord Massey. They live down in Rockbrook, and there's no doubt that some of them would have worked on the Massey estate, as many other families. But you'll be going back a couple of generations now, you know, to that point. When the estate collapsed, many of these people would initially have had a problem because their employment was now gone, and they had to adapt. In the case of John O'Kelly's family, the Caseys seem to have adapted very well because they had a business acumen. Now we're walking now, as you can see, through what would have been the vegetable gardens here. And we're just going to swing back out along by the river. And then we come up to the sawmills up above. Now there is an old shooting track all the way up here, brings you up to Crua Mountain. Nice walk. If you're ever out for a walk, I'll show it to you. But I have an interesting photograph here that I'm going to show you up here of a shooting party. Now we're coming up now very soon to another feature that is worth looking at. There's a lovely waterfall in there.
Yeah, there's a steep climb here up now, isn't there?
Oh, there is, yeah. And there's been growth of laurel along here, which has kind of taken over the place, which is a pity. And I wouldn't like Keeves now to turn it into a kind of a manicured park, but I think some of this laurel could be stripped away so you could see the river and see the waterfalls.
See the waterfalls,
Look at this feature here. There was general acceptance of this as being an ice house, the predecessor to the fridge.
This is this kind of oval-shaped
construction.
It looks like an ice house.
It looks like an ice house, and that they would have stored food in there. Now, there's a much bigger ice house on the other side of the wall, up near the reservoir. So what they would have done in winter, they would create pools on the river, dam the river to create pools so that ice would form. And then they would lift the sheets of ice up and put it in here, and that would keep the food cool, fresh.
So this was in fact an ice making house.
No. This was an ice house. The way you made the ice was to dam the river in spots. Yeah. Or literally, the reservoir was an ideal place.
When the water was still,
it would freeze better.
Yeah.
And then when it was frozen, to lift the ice
up here
and bring it in here. Now, there's another feature up here that I'll show you that is of particular interest just here. You're almost into forensic archaeology here now, you see, and trying to find these little remnants.
Must have been great detective work for you going around and now you discovering see all now. These. Oh, yes.
Right. Wow. There would have been a dam here. This would have been deeper. See the steps there now, like steps. And the water would have been diverted in here. And these were sand filters, you know, they would filter the water. And can you see the pipe down there?
Yeah.
See that pipe? Now, that was the pipe down to the fountains in the garden. Because if you think of fountains and all this, how would you get a fountain to shoot up? And just like down at the house, you had to have a tank in the attic. Of course, there's no attic, we're just further up the mountain. Do you follow me?
And they use the decline, the
natural gravity. Yes. So the pressure from here
and the power of the water
would be sufficient to shoot the water up out of the fountains. Now, you had to filter it well because there was a danger of grit and that getting into it. But you can see this is a filter trap here. You see, and there would have been sand in that.
Describe that, Frank.
Well, basically, it's like the steps of a stairs, except that instead of steps, you have like little buckets at each stage, you see. And the water flows from one and into the other, but each one has sand in it, and it's trapping any grit. And so that the water has to go down through this sand and come out purified at the bottom. And it has to do that a number of times before it gets into the pipe. And the pipe goes on down to the fountains.
But it is magnificent, isn't it? The whole construction.
Yeah.
And this was all done 200 years ago.
1800 it started, yes. And Luke White did the house. Luke White died around 1812 and left the estate to Samuel and his wife. They didn't have any children, but she particularly was into gardening. And she hired Ninny and Niven. And he did all the gardens. And they were renowned in their day. I mean, that article from the gardening magazine around 1860, that is very valuable insofar as it takes you step by step through the whole thing at that time. Now, you see this spot we're coming to here? Well, we're back on the main driveway again here, you see? And it's a walk down back to where we started. Now,
so we've completed a circle.
More or less. Now, the carriages for the shooting parties, that's the shooting path. See it going up there?
I do.
And on up onto the feather beds.
Yeah, meandering up along the hill.
Straight, a lovely walk. Just go for a walk up there. And in fact, if you didn't want to go all the way, just before you leave the estate, there's a bridge across the river and you can come down the other side. But traditionally, this is where they took photographs of the shooting parties.
Oh,
and there's that
look
spot
at
there
this.
Now.
Yeah.
You're looking at that spot. And that is around 1910. And that's Lord Massey there.
With all their
shooting gear. That's Lord Cloncurry.
Mm-hmm.
That is Somerville, the gamekeeper. He always had his staff impeccably dressed. See the gamekeeper? Cut him there. That's Somerville. Now, when you go up onto the Crewe Road, you'll see a cottage up there called Keeper's Cottage. And that was and still is the Somerville house. There were gate lodges right around the whole estate, you know what I mean? But the actual cottage is called Keeper's Cottage, and it would have been a big one for his day. This was a traditional place where the shooting party stopped to have a photograph. The one we're looking at was taken around 1910, judging by the age of Lord Massey in the photograph. It shows a shooting party, obviously ascendancy people by the way they're dressed. The gamekeeper, Somerville, is up the back with the gun in his hand, and he and his family had a cottage up on the Crewe Road, up near the Crewe car park. This man on the right is very interesting. That's Lord Cloncurry. And Lord Cloncurry was the original have gun will travel, because if you go around Ireland and look at photographs of shooting parties in ascendancy families, 99 times out of 100 Lord Cloncurry is in the shooting party. So he seems to have done nothing else but go around shooting. He was the bane of chambermaids, because you see his big beard, he used to dye that beard mauve. with what God alone knows, but he left a trail of mauve linen, bed linen, behind him everywhere that he went, and he was dreaded by chambermaids. That's Lord Cloncurry.
No, I just want to show you something here.
The Masseys would have had different people with different responsibilities here within the estate.
Oh yeah, there's a whole hierarchy. There's a whole hierarchy. I mean, you had head gardeners, you had gamekeepers. I'm sure he had assistants. You would have had foresters.
Who was the steward?
The steward was Maurice Fox, and Maurice Fox lived in the original Connolly House, which is still there and later became a restaurant, and he would have been the steward. He would have administered, the administrator, for want of a better word, bookkeeper. That's who people went to when they had a problem. Now, just in here to your left, there's remains of a little building. See the remains of a little building in there?
Yes.
And that was the sawmills. And over here, there was a dam. And you see this narrow bit here? There would have been the wheel there for the power. And there was a whole sawmill operated there. There was a gravel pit further up. But this sawmill, in the 1940s, see the number of buildings there, there was a man named Hans Veitch, who was a Dutchman, and he was in the business of making charcoal, which comes from burning wood and lettered embers on. And that's the only time when it's known that Lord Massey actually worked and earned a few bob, because Hans Veitch used to pay him to collect bits and pieces of wood around the place and bring it up to him. And he'd have a little billy can hanging out of his belt. He always wore a trench coat, old battered trench coat. Now, I think myself, Lord Massey at that stage, he'd had a drink problem all his life. He really wasn't up to work. I think it was an act of charity by Hans Veitch, you know, give him a few bob, and it was somewhere to come up and chat, because his wife was out working all day. But that's the only known time when he actually was known to do a bit of work and get paid for it.
Wasn't it a sad ending to his life?
Well, you see, if you understand that his grandfather died when he was 21. Now, up to his grandfather's death, they were living a very, very luxurious life. He had been educated in Harrow. He had every expectation that he would in time become Lord Massey. Within weeks of the grandfather's death, when the will was read, it became known that not only was all the Land Act monies gone, but that he had borrowed heavily on the properties to maintain his lifestyle. So the whole thing collapsed overnight. Everything had to be sold off. Now you're talking 1915, 1916. Who could pay money for stuff in Ireland? And I traced the catalogues of the auctions both here and in Hermitage in Limerick. And if you see the prices that some of the things went for, you'd weep. Absolutely weep. Some of them, Carpaggios, Fra Angelicas, if you had even one of them now, you were to put. But cartloads of Irish silver were sold off for a pittance. And they still couldn't make ends meet. Now, young Hammond, who, as I said, was 21 when his grandfather died, he unfortunately developed a drinking problem at a very young age. Within the family, the blame is put on an old butler in Killiquay, who apparently just kept pouring drink into the young lad. But unfortunately, he had no idea how to manage affairs, how to handle anything, whatever. And their situation, his father was still alive, living down in Tipperary in Ardfinnan. The young man later married a Catholic, Margaret Morden, and the family cut him off, and things just went from bad to worse, until eventually in 1924 the bank decided the situation was hopeless, and the last remaining house at that stage was taken from them by the bank, and Hammond lived the rest of his life in the little beehive cottage. Sad life, wasted life in a way, but he was a victim Not helped by the drink problem, of course, you know. So the real heroine is his wife, Margaret, who just rolled up her sleeves, got a job in the Irish sweepstake, and for the next 34 years, she was the backbone, kept him going, and their son, Hughie, I think rightly, decided the situation was hopeless, went to England, fought in the Second World War, married an Irish girl over there, stayed there and reared his family over there.
Well, Frank Tracy, it's been an amazing journey and an incredible life story of Lord Massey and his magnificent estate here, or what was a magnificent estate. But thank you for bringing me around and showing me all the, reliving those great years. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome, Morris. That's grand.